It remains an unfortunate fact of life that money can't buy happiness. It can, however, buy you a new shirt, magnet, sticker, mug, or journal featuring exclusive designs related to this podcast. By visiting ahistoryofjapan.threadless.com and buying some of the items featured there, you get yourself something beautiful and help support this podcast at the same time. Again, that's ahistoryofjapan.threadless.com. Visit the store today. Hello, and welcome to A History of Japan. Season 6, Episode 3, The Age of Uncertainty. In the first episode this season, we discussed the nobility, and in the second episode, we discussed the commoners. In this final survey episode, we will explore the lives and perspectives of two groups who existed in the murky space between aristocracy and peasantry, the Buddhist clergy and the samurai. While Kukai and Saicho had brought new, exciting iterations of Buddhism to Japan in the early Heian, by the later Heian, things were looking somewhat grim for the religious establishment. The effort to synchronize the indigenous religions, adopting the native kami as enlightened Buddhas, bodhisattvas, and protectors of the Buddhist faith, was practically complete, but many monasteries were rocked by scandals as their members were caught in immoral behavior like drinking alcohol and having orgies. The women of these cloisters were usually blamed for this licentiousness, and by the late 900s the court was practically blocking the ordination of any new nuns. The declining population meant fewer laborers to build new temples and auxiliary structures, which resulted in expensive, slow-moving construction projects, which sometimes stagnated during times of drought or pestilence. The massive complex that Kukai had lobbied to build atop Mount Koya took decades just to raise the main buildings, much less all of the chapels, pagodas, and shrines that he believed it needed. The rivalry between the Tendai and the Shingon sects continued to grow during this time, though the Tendai had larger problems than contending with the imperial court's favored form of Buddhism. It billed itself as Big Tent Buddhism, seeking to incorporate and consolidate the practices and rituals of all the various sects from around Japan. Naturally, this welcoming, compassionate attitude led to its leaders getting pulled into various theological debates, which quickly became heated and bitter. This is not actually a huge surprise, given that Saicho himself had been drawn into many bitter disputes with the Nara schools during his lifetime, and it is within reason to suspect that the Tendai founder had a problem with authority, especially given Kukai's accomplishment of debating the finer points of Buddhism with the Nara schools while remaining in their good graces. The rustic Nara schools were no longer a threat to the Tendai domination by the later Heian, as the Tendai were able to ordain their own monks and nuns without the blessings of Todaiji. Thus the debates turned inward, between monks of various standings. While rigorous debate may sometimes be helpful in moving larger conversations forward within a belief system, in the difficult years of the later Heian it led to bitter rivalries, cults of personality, schisms, and even violent reprisals. The Enryakuji temple complex atop Mount Hiei would see a schism between the followers of Ennin and Enchin. You may remember Ennin from the last season, as we discussed his unfortunate journey to China, wherein he endured a great wave of government-sponsored anti-Buddhist persecution. He died in 864, having served as abbot of the Tendai sect, and later a monk named Enchin took over as abbot. The shrinking coffers of the imperial court meant less money to fund the various temples and monasteries, so competition became fierce between the various communities. We will explore the conflict between the followers of Ennin and Enchin in greater detail later this season, as well as the efforts of Abbot Ryogen to restore the unity within the Tendai school. By the later Heian period, the conflicts between the rival groups within the Tendai sect were so severe that armed clashes resulted, which eventually led to the creation of a new type of monk who defended the faith not in high-minded debates and overwrought treatises, but with sword, spear, and bow. For now, however, let's focus on the growing cast of warriors of the later Heian. I mentioned last season, but it's worth repeating, that the word which became samurai meant one who serves. Those who took up the way of the warrior during the Heian period were primarily agents of kuge, local elites, and provincial governments. As the national government eased its former restrictions against Choans acquiring new land in an effort to alleviate the famine in the late 900s and early 1000s, many of the larger estates needed guardians to protect their expanding portfolios. By the end of the Heian period, the samurai would essentially function as its own unique class of noble warriors. The later Heian period would eventually see the samurai become the driving force in national politics, but they certainly didn't begin that way. In the later half of the 900s, samurai were generally drawn from the lesser sons of lower-ranking nobles and from the provincial elite. And while Heian-kyo was the national center of art and culture, it was by no means safe. Burglary and arson were common occurrences, and the Imperial Guard became increasingly ceremonial in its duties, which meant that safety became a private matter. Throughout the late 900s and early 1000s, the most powerful of the kuge began keeping retinues of bodyguards who, in addition to preserving the life of their employer, also did his dirty work. This sometimes included setting fire to the homes of rivals, intimidating said rivals' subordinates, and, at times, outright assassination. A diary entry of influential kuge Fujiwara Sanesuke, dating to 1028, tells of an incident in which a provincial governor's residence in the capital was burned by a band of armed men and reflects, well, the capital is no different than the Kanto. This may have been a slight exaggeration, but a combination of nobility feuding with one another over illicit rumors, the Fujiwara regents and their supporters eliminating potential rivals, and private feuds that occasionally flared up between the warriors themselves meant that Heian-kyo was no longer the capital of peace and tranquility in spite of its name. In the provinces, meanwhile, the samurai served as enforcers of the status quo by collecting taxes, guarding against theft, and defending the borders of their employer's land, whether they worked for a noble samurai like the local Minamoto or for a monastery that managed a shoin. They also were often given positions as priests and ritualists at indigenous shrines, and there appears to have been a connection between the regional kami cults and samurai, though unfortunately this link is not yet well understood. The transition of the Imperial Guard to a ceremonial body was accompanied by a general decline in the readiness and discipline of the so-called standing army nationwide. While Emperor Kammu's abolition of the national conscription would stay firmly in place, the government still paid the salaries of the guards posted at the Dazaifu Fortress. As we saw at the end of last season, however, this standing army was soundly and easily defeated by Fujiwara Sumitomo and his pirates, and the fortress in question burned to the ground. You might think that this event alone would serve as a wake-up call to the imperial court that Dazaifu could not protect them from an invasion, but it seems that the court no longer considered invasion a real possibility. Dazaifu Fortress was built in the late 600s out of fear of an imminent invasion of the Tang Dynasty in response to Japanese interference in the wars of the Korean Peninsula. Nearly 300 years later, fears of such an invasion would have seemed paranoid and ridiculous, especially considering that the Tang Dynasty had fallen, and the new dynasty who eventually reunited China wasn't as interested in global conquest. Those tasked with manning Dazaifu Fortress generally spent their days fishing, lounging, and soaking up a sweet government salary. However, in the early 1000s, this neglect of duty would exact a heavy toll on those so-called soldiers. In 1019, The islands of Tsushima and Iki were raided by a huge pirate fleet that set sail from northern Korea. The garrisons there were slaughtered, and the civilians enslaved. The pirates themselves were Jurchens, a tribal ethnic group who ranged throughout northern China and Manchuria. They set their sights on Dazaifu next, landing their ships en masse on an island in Hakata Bay and using it as a foothold to raid the surrounding areas in northern Kyushu. They even managed to kill the local governor, one Fujiwara Notada. The administration at Dazaifu, to their credit, acted quickly and raised an army to defend themselves from this menace, probably drawing from the samurai who served the local elites. The pirates were driven away, but the Jurchen adventurers managed to kidnap over 1,200 Japanese women and children, most of whom they successfully brought back to their homelands as slaves. Goryeo, to their credit, managed to intercept 8 of the ships and rescue a little under 300 Japanese prisoners and successfully repatriate them to Japan. The others, however, were left to their fate. There was a brief panic at court over this event, which many nobles initially believed was the first step in a full-scale invasion. When it became clear that this was just a smash-and-grab raid, this helped to assuage those fears, though some were convinced that an invasion by steppe nomads was a real and present threat that should be guarded against. Because the northern reaches of the Japanese archipelago were still poorly charted at this time, it was widely believed that the island of Hokkaido, then called Ezo, was actually a peninsula that connected to what is today eastern Russia. Mounting any kind of preemptive invasion of Ezo was beyond the capabilities of the later Heian government, but future generations would look upon the Isle of the Ainu people as a barbarian frontier and a dangerous strategic liability which demanded the civilizing influence of the Yamato. The entire episode with the Jurchen pirate raids would later be dubbed the Toi Invasion, Toi being a Korean loanword that meant barbarian. While it was shocking and terrifying to the court, it seems they were convinced that the local administration of Kyushu had handled the incident well enough, and it did nothing to alter their attitudes toward having any kind of competent national army loyal to the central government in Heian-kyo. While the lower-ranking warriors would generally stay in the province where they worked, the samurai who boasted imperial lineage, those with the surnames Minamoto and Taira, would typically spend at least part of every year in the capital. They would connect with their noble patrons, discuss the annual revenues from their estates, and maybe even go on a hunt or two. In exchange for their loyalty and support, the Taira and Minamoto leaders were usually given plum appointments as governors of wealthy provinces, sometimes serving in 2 governorships at once. As with all offices in Japan that begin with official appointment, these governorships and assistant governorships and every other provincial office held by samurai eventually became hereditary rather than at the pleasure of the emperor. Some of these well-born samurai, seemingly following in Taira Masakado's footsteps, began to think of themselves as the rightful lord of their provinces, and not as a servant of the government. One such man was Taira Tadatsune. Yes, that's right, another Taira rebel. Tadatsune's story is not as compelling as Masakado's, though his rebellion lasted longer. In 1028, shortly after the death of Regent Fujiwara Michinaga, the most powerful regent in Japanese history, Taira Tadatsune attacked the government headquarters in Awa province and killed its governor, one Taira Koretada, by burning him to death. This was likely part of a personal dispute, as conflict within the Taira family was still common in this period. Following this brutal attack, Tadatsune led his army into Kazusa, where he seized the provincial capital. Sound familiar? While Tadatsune did not mimic Masakado's conquest march around the Kanto, he successfully dominated Awa, Kazusa, and Shimosa for the time being. The response at court was, predictably, to appoint a shogun and raise an army to defeat him. However, the choice in leadership was made based on who was most closely connected to the new regent, Fujiwara Yorimichi, not necessarily who was the best qualified. Thus, while the obvious choice was Minamoto Yorinobu, a warrior who not only had an impressive track record, but who was also Tadatsune's patron, instead the regent chose Taira Naokata, thanks to the lobbying of his influential father. While it's easy to sneer at what seems like corrupt cronyism, the newly installed regent may have been motivated by caution rather than undue influence. Giving someone an army was a potential risk. He needed to make sure he was giving such power to someone he could trust. It is also worth mentioning that Taira Naokata had a political power base in the Kanto provinces of Sagami and Izu. Yorinobu, for his part, seemed only too happy to let the newly appointed shogun duke it out with his wayward vassal while he tended to his own clan's affairs. Unfortunately, we do not have accounts of the actual battles fought across the Kanto at this time, but what sources we do have indicate that the government's army took too long to get into the fight, Tadatsune outfought Shogun Naokata's troops repeatedly, and the damage wrought upon farms across the Kanto directly led to massive food shortages in the coming years. After 2 years of false starts, poor performance on the battlefield, and indiscriminate destruction, the court finally recalled Taira Naokata and appointed Minamoto Yorinobu as the new shogun. When Tadatsune heard of this development, he disbanded his troops, shaved his head, and took orders as a Buddhist monk. Whether this abdication resulted from a sense of loyalty to his old patron, or a certainty that he could not hope to prevail against him in battle, is not clear, but it is interesting that he sought sanctuary in religion. Clergy were generally considered off-limits, and there were stiff penalties in those days for harming a priest or a monk. The imperial court may have had a difficult time finding a way to punish Tadatsune for his rebellion, given his new status, but we can only guess at what legal trickery they planned to employ. Shogun Minamoto Yorinobu took him into custody in the spring of 1031, and on their way back to the capital, Tadatsune became ill and died. The destruction of 3 years of warfare in the Kanto resulted in drastic long-term food shortages. In an effort to kickstart crop production in the wake of Tadatsune's rebellion, the government quickly rescinded its previous prohibitions against private estates acquiring new lands. This mass privatization effort resulted in a huge loss of land for public use, as the shoguns sought to bring more acreage under their stewardship through reclamation and soliciting donations. The Taira and Minamoto governors seized the opportunity to parcel out the estates they controlled as income-producing rewards for the services of fighting men. As a reward for his service, Minamoto Yorinobu was gifted extensive estates in Kanto, which he used to establish his clan as the preeminent samurai of the region. By the end of this season, the Minamoto clan will reside still on these estates, and their influence will be felt throughout the Kanto and beyond. This marks the end of our survey episodes for this season. My hope is that they give you a better idea of big picture issues of the later Heian, and that they will help you understand events that occur during our narrative episodes. Next time, we will get back to that narrative and discuss those who ruled over Japan during the later Heian period. No, not the emperors, obviously. I am referring, of course, to their trusted advisors, the regents. Until then, thank you for listening. If you would like access to exclusive bonus episodes, as well as ad-free versions of the regular episodes, please consider supporting this podcast at patreon.com/ahistoryofjapan. ...